Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jonathan Curiel and I'll be your moderator for today's program called Islamic Enlightenment, the Struggle Between Faith and Reason. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Christopher de Bellegueux. He is an authority on Islam in the Middle East. He's a contributor to The Economist, New York Review of Books, BBC, Britain's Guardian, and has written many books, including Portrait of Persia, Mohammed Mossadegh, and the tragic Anglo-American coup, and also the book In the Rose Garden of the Martyrs, a memoir of Iran. Dr. Bellegueux is a prominent speaker on Islam, and we welcome his speech today, his talk today. Please welcome Christopher de Bellegueux.
Thank you very much. Thank you to you, Jonathan, to you, Celia, and to everyone else who has taken the time to come here today. A lovely day. Apparently, you don't often see days like this in San Francisco, so I know the sacrifice that is being made. Something that Celia mentioned in her talk was something that I picked up on, and that was she was asking you in a future program to remember that this is not a debating club and to remember to be civil and to listen to other people's views. I sense, looking at the debate that preceded the second round of the French election the other day, seeing the way that people speak at each other in Washington, D.C., and the way that the media in this country and in my country has been increasingly polarized, and the political class seems to think that they have a license to fling vile accusations at each other and vile language. And they seem to think that this has no effect on the population at large. And as someone with children, I find it deeply, deeply unsatisfying. So I'm very glad that Celia has reminded us, at least those who are members of civilized society, that it is important to respect, listen to, and take on board other people's views. Having said that, my book is a refutation of a view. It was conceived from the idea that I gained over the course of my career as a journalist in the Middle East and elsewhere, that there was, and this has been subsequently confirmed after I returned to the West to continue to pick up my life in the West, which I did in 2007, that there is a view of Islam which has only got stronger and has only got more pervasive, which says that the lands and cultures of Islam are implacably opposed to change, to progress, to modernity. I know medievalist historians who hate the fact that their chosen field of study is only used in a pejorative sense. This is medieval, that is medieval. And the word medieval comes up a lot with respect to Islam and Islamic societies. And on one hand, you can see why. Because a lot of what is happening now in the Middle East does strike one as very, very old-fashioned indeed. However, there is a great deal of modernity churning in among that confrontation, those descents into barbarism. And even the nature of jihadi Islam is itself infused, permeated with many modern ideas and many modern concepts. So we have to look at much of what is happening in the world of Islam as a facet of modernity, and we have to treat it on those terms. The book that I have written deals with a slightly different subject. It goes back into the historical record. It consults the people who have ruled countries, but also the people who worked and lived in those countries. The countries I'm referring to are Turkey, Egypt, and Iran. Of course, in the period that I'm speaking about, they didn't all exist in those terms, but that is what they have become. And the idea that I'm proposing is that the period between 1798, which is when Napoleon invaded Egypt, to around about the beginning of the First World War, saw an extraordinary modernization of the Middle East, a modernization that has been completely ignored. And the way that I have shown this is not by saying, oh, I sort of think that this is the case, or by consulting other top-down histories. It is really by looking at those people who were involved in the modernization of the Middle East. And what I have discovered is that alongside a certain number of authoritarian modernizing rulers, whose motivations were basically military to begin with, there was a stratum of society that grew over the course of the 19th century and became deeply and profoundly interested in change and reform. And to those who say that change and reform are inherently anti-Islamic, I would refer them to the characters in this book, because they are Muslims who changed, who reformed, who imported ideas, who modified them and introduced them in their own countries. And I'm going to run through just a few of those remarkable changes now. I start the book with Jane Eyre. Yeah, because Jane Eyre, a fictional character, but a true character, was changing her life in the 1820s, using the post office, using the newspaper, putting advertisements in for a new job, going along a turnpike road using a four-wheeled conveyance. She wasn't judged by society. Society didn't say that a young woman of education but little means shouldn't be roaming about the countryside on her own, shouldn't be taking up a new situation, shouldn't be falling in love without the permission of her father or her brother or some other male relative. And it struck me, well, how would Jane Eyre have gone down in the Middle East in 1820? Well, no one would have been able to read it. Of course, it was written later, but we think it was set in about 1820 because literacy was so pitifully low, about between 2 and 3% probably across the Middle East. There were no post offices. There was no paved roads between urban centres. There were no newspapers. There were no advertisements. There was no possibility for a woman really to be educated apart from a tiny, minuscule minority. And so the idea of Jane Eyre was a kind of premise that would have been absurd, almost deranged in the Middle East. But come to the end of the century, and you will find Jane Eyres appearing, not in large numbers, but in significant enough numbers for them to be role models. And they use the new technologies of the newspaper. They start to write. They start to disseminate their ideas. They start to travel. You find Turkish feminists appearing at the Chicago World Fair, traveling around Europe on their own. And you find them demanding change and becoming part of a political process. And around the turn of the 20th century, you find education for women beginning to take off in a major way in the main urban centres of the Middle East. And middle-class families, for by this time middle-class families had begun to appear, decide that it is now unacceptable not to educate their daughters. Other things, slavery falls into abeyance. The plague, 200 years after the last outbreak of the plague in Europe, it is still raging unchecked across the Middle East. But some simple measures are introduced and the plague is eradicated. Theatres of anatomy appear. There's a story in the book about how that was first introduced into Egypt against the injunction, according to some accounts, of the Prophet Muhammad, who said you shouldn't cut up a dead body. By the turn of the 20th century, Egypt has a chief mufti who is issuing fatwas of an incredibly progressive nature. You have had constitutional revolutions in Iran, Turkey, and Egypt. All of these things are happening. The whole region is in turmoil and churning. And yet we in the West, did we see it? Do we see it now? I don't think we did then. If you read the accounts of the East that are written by Western travelers, they mostly concentrate on the unchanging aspect of the East, the decorative, the immobile. What they don't, or very rarely, acknowledge is that these societies are undergoing incredible change. Now, was this idea an imported idea, the idea of modernity? Well, it was certainly imported to the extent that the facets and vehicles of modernity were brought in by Muslims who had been abroad, or by foreigners who came as advisors, or as merchants, or as military advisors to the Middle East. However, there was adaptation going on. What was happening was a hybrid form of modernity was emerging, a form of modernity that answered both to the Islamic, to the cultural inheritance of the past, but also answered to the universal desires and looking to the future. There was a liberal moment, I believe, before the First World War, and then the First World War intervened in crushing fashion. Because the First World War not only obliterated the Middle East politically, armies roamed freely with incredible dynamism and destructive power across the region. Famines were left in their wake. Governments fell, set up again, and fell again. And the whole of that hopeful sense of progression, that hopeful sense that autonomy, self-expression, and political maturity were on the way, was done away with. The Ottoman Empire was consigned to the dustbin of history. And what took its place was the colonization of much of the Middle East by Britain and France. This was a huge, huge disappointment to all those Arabs, particularly Arabs, who had fondly believed that their hour of independence and their hour of self-expression was at hand, particularly in Egypt, which had been promised by Britain, a degree of self-expression that simply wasn't offered at the end of the war. Those two main territories that did not get independence, that retained their independence, the new state of Turkey, the new Republic of Turkey, and the monarchy of Iran, embarked on a kind of defensive modernization, an illiberal modernization that looked to Rome, looked to the Rome of Mussolini for its inspiration, rather than looking to the liberal traditions of the West. And so you find a militarism, an enforced secularization. You will not write your language in this way. You will introduce new characters to your language. You will not dress in that old-fashioned way. You will dress like modern Westerners. You will incorporate all sorts of technologies into your lives that are jarring and require years of careful introduction before they can be properly mastered. And this is the story of Turkey and of Iran. And we now see the reaction. We see the reaction in Iran, 1979, the Islamic Revolution, when people were fed up of being told that their indigenous traditions counted for naught. And we see it now in Turkey, with the rise of Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his ability to take the country in a very different direction. And it is now the Ottoman Empire that is the point of nostalgic departure for the modern Turkish Republic. It's not Atatürk's modernizing revolution. And Egypt, well, it too lurched into Islamist violence and briefly into Muslim Brotherhood rule before the return of that familiar figure, familiar to all of us, the army officer, strong man, who says to the West, you can rely on me to make sure that all those nasty obscurantist currents are suppressed, and in return, don't ask any questions about human rights. And this is a false dichotomy, and it's the dichotomy we find ourselves in now, and will increasingly, should the fighting in Syria ever come to a halt, and already in Iraq, that dichotomy between a democratic pluralist society and one that is controlled by an authoritarian, because of the risk, so it seems to us, is too great to give too much to democracy to people who don't have the wherewithal to deal with it and handle it and master it. And just finally, I would say it's worth remembering that our own trajectory, our political and historical and social trajectory, took many, many hundreds of years. And so it is quite unreasonable to expect a telescoped quality or a much more expedited quality to modernization and enlightenment values in the Middle East. So in short, enlightenment, it's been there. We've had it in the Middle East. It is now on the back foot, but we must see what we can do to help it in the future. Thank you.
Thank you for a reminder to our listening audiences that we're in a program with Christopher de Bellegueux, the author of The Islamic Enlightenment and the Struggle Between Faith and Reason, 1798 to Modern Times. Your book, as you said, starts with, a lot of things, but one of the things is Napoleon's invasion of Egypt. And from there, you describe the kind of tussle between governments and people on the ground, and especially as educated leaders decided to send select people to France and England and elsewhere, there was a kind of transformation of these societies. And among the many people that you describe are women who would be described now as feminists. And you talk about the different ways that they, lecture in public about Islam, but also about their culture. Can you talk about one? I mean, there are lots of women in the book. One of them is a woman from Iran named Kirat al-Ain. But there are lots of women in the book, and I'm wondering if you could just describe one of them as it fits into the narrative that you just talked about.
Well, the section of the book that deals with Jane Eyre, I go on to describe a woman called Fatima Aliyeh, who in some ways encapsulated the idea of Jane Eyre's coming into existence. And her background, this is typical because the first educated class of women in the Middle East was the upper class. So her father had been an Ottoman statesman in the middle of the century, someone who was considered fairly interested in modernization, who was in dialogue with the Western powers to see what could be brought in terms of norms of government, in terms of legal reforms, because the Ottoman Empire was involved in legal reforms. I think where it came to the cultural aspect, which is where Fatima Aliyeh was instrumental, there was a bit more hesitancy, and it is notable that Fatima Aliyeh, as a young girl growing up in Istanbul, had to learn French, which was the language of modernity, secretly. Her mother, when she announced that she wanted to learn French, her mother said that it was the language of the infidel and no good could come of it. And so she did. She learned French in secret. And this was really a window onto another world, because there was so much that she could, as a result, begin to read. She then married a man who at first disapproved of her literary ambitions. And it took him about 6 or 7 years to come round to the idea that there was really no harm in her writing and disseminating her views. So she became what one could call really one of the first Turkish female columnists in the newspapers that were then starting up. So the rise of journalism is immensely significant to this story, because it allows people to communicate with each other remotely, as it were. So Fatima Aliyeh can sit in her garret and write her pieces and then communicate with a much larger number of women who are reading her pieces. She wrote novels as well. The novel made its entry into the Middle East at this time, and it was found, I mean, it's not for nothing that the novel is the modern art form par excellence. It allows a form of expression that simply wasn't possible using the old poetic conventions. Language, at the same time, underwent an immense transformation. A man called Ibrahim Shenasi came back from Paris, having observed a lot of the revolution of 1848, and other political events that happened after that, returned and immediately embarked on a career as an editor that meant that the language changed. It became pared down. It became simplified. A lot of concepts had to be imported into Turkish that simply didn't exist. A lot of words had to be modified. Words for republic and human rights started to make their appearance. The nation, who could define a nation when up till then the nation had been your religion. So all of these were reflected in the work of Fatma Ali, and she was indeed the woman I referred to who was invited to the Chicago World Fair in, is it 1893? Yeah, 1893. And she then had to travel around France because her daughter went too far to the West and converted to Catholicism and entered an order in Paris, and she was deeply upset by that. And she travelled to France to try and get her daughter back. Her daughter, after her death, said that her mother had devoted her life to, I think I paraphrase, the struggle of women, the struggle, and women's rights. And at the beginning of Fatma Aliye's life, there was no struggle and there were no women's rights. So this is just an indication of the very, very quick transformation that was taking place across the Middle East.
And another really good example of that you write about in the book is in Egypt, and it's Hassan Attar. And how after France's takeover of Egypt was completely enchanted by books and French people, and especially, for example, the way certain French people spoke Arabic, and he loved the kind of cross-cultural nature of that. Now, his narrative is really interesting, and in the end, he was sent into exile, but then brought back, and he became a rector at Al-Azhar. Yeah. One of the most distinguished, if not the most distinguished Islamic institution in the world.
So Hassan al-Attar is one of the sort of, he's a representative of the false dawn, because there was so much opposition then that his effect was not in the end very lasting. But he's an immensely interesting person, because when the French arrived, Napoleon wanted to show off how advanced the French were, so he set up a kind of brains trust in Cairo, and he brought a remarkable array of young scientists and researchers who were going to produce this immense encyclopedia that they then produced, and they were trying to find out literally everything about Egypt, from the archaeological remains to dissecting every kind of animal and bird that they could get their hands on, to working out whether Nile had its source, finding out the religious beliefs of the people, medicine. The whole thing was put into this encyclopedia. And of course, this is the encyclopedia that Edward Said later on described as the kind of Orientalist exercise par excellence. It's, you know, it's reducing a country to books that you put in a library. This is not how Hassan al-Attar found it. He found the approach of the French to knowledge to be utterly extraordinary and, as you say, enchanting. To go into their brains trust and to find books using movable type in such profusion, when movable type had not even entered the Islamic world, hadn't entered into general currency, was extraordinary. And so pretty soon after that, movable type did come in. To find the Prophet Muhammad depicted in pictorial form, of course, that was a big no-no as far as Orthodox Islam was concerned. However, between the lines of his writing, you can sense a kind of admiration. Here is the Prophet, and he's incredibly handsome, and there he is on the page. You can almost touch him. And then he went. It was a difficult time after the French left. There was a backlash against everything to do with the French. So he went to Turkey for a while, and then he returned. And he was very interested in medicine, and he was also interested in the medical achievements of Islam in the past. And he found that some of the discoveries that were attributed to the West, for example, William Harvey, the pulmonary motion of the heart, had in fact been discovered by a Syrian called Ibn al-Nafis several hundred years before. So this is one of the ways in which the Muslim reformers smuggled these new ideas past the Orthodox, because they could say, You say that this is an innovation. In fact, it isn't at all. It's been dormant, but within Islamic culture for a very long time. And what we must do is simply revive it. But his most lasting contribution was to theatres of anatomy. It was he who issued a ruling saying that theatres of anatomy should be permitted. You couldn't advance medicine without theatres of anatomy and dissecting human bodies. And so, very, very secretively, without telling the populace at large, taking care only to use the corpses of non-Muslims, this tradition entered the Islamic world. And then you will find in my book, when you all buy a copy afterwards, that there is a wonderful photograph that repays the cost itself, which is of a group of Istanbul medical students in the middle of the century sitting for a group photograph. And they're all wearing their very, very neat doublets, and they're wearing their fezes, and they look extremely serious, all sitting like this. And then you see that between them are arrayed an incredible cornucopia of human remains. There are skulls and other limbs just arrayed around the photograph. A British, a Scot called Macfarlane, who was a kind of high church Tory, was absolutely shocked by the extent to which skepticism, atheism, agnosticism had spread among these medical students in the mid 19th century. Again, this is not an image that is popularly held of Islam, the idea that Islamic culture has undergone a very significant slippage in terms of morals, in terms of religious belief.
Well, one of the things that you make very clear in your book is that you're talking now about a sort of this private world, you know, behind doors, but there's very much a public world that you write about in the book, The Enlightenment, where people, visitors, but also, of course, people on the ground could see the changes. And in some ways, one of the topics you address is the religious leaders' reluctance to have that be open. Because I think you say that the printing press came to Turkey in the 1490s, but then it was banned. And that was really only in, you know, the 1800s or so that it came into being. And when they started to print Qurans, that's when the relationship between the clerics and, you know, people who everyday people could pray changed a lot.
I think it did, absolutely. And one of the interesting things is that when the Gutenberg press was introduced in the West, of course, it had a great effect on secular culture, but initially it was used most often in order to propagate Christianity. And of course, it was extremely useful to the Reformation. In the Islamic world, there was a very large vested interest, a profession of professional copyists whose job it was to write the Quran. And they did so with enormous elaboration and enormous skill, and they, in some cases, charged a lot of money. And then you get the whole tradition of the illuminated Quran, which, of course, is a step up. Now, these people did not, of course, want printing on demand, as it were, because it would drive them out of business. There was a big representation among the clergy that regarded this alien and infidel invention as something that shouldn't be allowed into any sort of proximity with the Word of God. This was overcome. Essentially, I think the first Quran went into press in the Middle East. Of course, it had gone into press elsewhere outside the Middle East long before that. The first Quran that went into press in the Middle East was in about 1830. But the major use that was put, that the new printing presses were put to, were largely secular. There was a big translation movement in Egypt in the 1830s that brought in a lot of Western political thought and philosophical thought, and a lot of Enlightenment books were translated into Arabic. A lot was also translated into Turkish and later on into Persian. And so there was a secular use for the new technology. You refer to the division between the inner and outer world, and I think that the falling into abeyance of the harem, the sanctified space within the urban household that was reserved for women and for the rich, in the case of the rich, for eunuch slaves, was extremely important. And that did fall into abeyance. There was a very symbolic moment.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
It is impossible to exaggerate the extent to which the harem kept women of the upper and middle classes in a state of servitude and bondage. And ironically enough, it was poorer rural women who enjoyed, relative to their menfolk, a great deal more autonomy because they were deeply involved in the economy. However, the urban middle and upper class, that revolution took a lot longer took a long time to happen. And so you find the Iranian Shah at in the 1870s in a position where he had an enormous harem, and one of his he was the first person to have electric light in Iran, of course, and he had a game which he called Lights Out. And so he would gather all the women on the harem. And they were, such was the extraordinary atmosphere in the harem of competitiveness. Who was the senior wife? Who had the senior wife's ear? Who was in favor? Who was out of favor? That when he did the lights out, so it's a room like this, you turn out the lights, and all of you start attacking each other and screaming and yelling. And then 2 minutes later, we turn on the lights, and you're all dripping in blood and covered. Your hair's all matted. And then he sends you away to go and tidy yourselves up. And that is the extraordinary distorting effect of that system of the harem at its most bizarre. But then at the end of the beginning of the 20th century, the harem, it just becomes too expensive to keep up, and there is a change of Shah, and the new Shah says, "I'm going to have a greatly, drastically reduced harem," and suddenly these women who have been, they've been kept from education, they've been kept from outside life, they've been kept from any kind of development as human beings, then have to start making their way in the world because they're no longer being looked after. And so women now come into a state of increasing autonomy, men beginning to regard women as their natural helpmeet within society. Before, it had been complete segregation. The erotic poetry had been between men. Suddenly, romance between men and women starts to rise. And there's another interesting aspect to this. The men, of course, were not entirely altruistic in their motives. They did want women. As the idea of the nation rose, they thought it was incredibly important. If women were going to be in charge of raising the sons of the nation, then they should have certain attributes and education in order to be able to do so. So there was a patriotic necessity as well. We have to raise fine young sons in the future, and so our women have to be capable of doing that. So everything is linked. And this is why when people say, well, you know, it's all very well in the Middle East, a certain development has taken place, but in fact, it doesn't really mean very much. You know, if, for example, oh, fine, the Saudi women can drive, let's say. Oh, they're allowed to drive, but, you know, big deal. But each of these little events, each of these little evolutions has a major knock-on effect, a knock-on effect that in many cases is impossible to foresee.
I would like to remind our listening audience that this is a Commonwealth Club program called The Islamic Enlightenment, The Battle for Faith and Reason. We're speaking with Christopher de Bellegue, and we have lots of questions from the audience. One relates to a theme from the book, and that is the idea of the nation state and how a lot of leaders in Iran, Turkey, and Egypt played that up as a way to modernize their country. Now, the question from audience member is, what was the role of non-Islamic cultures in 19th century modernization? You know, the Coptic Christians, Jews, Armenians. You write about that in your book as it relates to the nation state, but in other ways.
The emphasis of the book is on Muslims in the Middle East. So I don't go into an enormous amount of detail about the interplay, except to one very important extent. There's a comparative role here. For example, the Armenians in Iran have been printing since the early 17th century. Of course, they've been printing for many years, centuries before the Muslims get around to doing so. There's a comparative thing here, but there's a legal thing which is even more important. And that is that under Sharia law, this is particularly relevant in the Ottoman Empire, the Ottomans had been known, and quite rightly so, for a degree of tolerance towards minorities that accorded perfectly with their understanding of Islamic law and also stood in contrast most notably with the experience of the Jews in Spain when they were expelled in 1492. It was the Ottoman Sultan who let them in. So this this idea of a dominant Muslim elite, into which, of course, everyone was welcome to adhere, and many people did. There was enormous amount of conversion, and those converts, there was no bar to high office. So many converts achieved very high office, both in the palace, but also in the administration, in military and naval affairs. But that status, imbalance in legal status, then began to be challenged in the 19th century. And it was challenged under pressure from the Western powers. The Western powers were not, I regret to say, entirely altruistic. By standing up for the Protestants in the Ottoman Empire, or the Armenians in the Ottoman Empire, or the Druze, or other minorities, essentially the Western powers were saying, I now have my proxy, and I now have an excuse to interfere and to criticize the Ottomans for not giving legal equality. And this was a question that greatly taxed Ottoman reformers, and they had, in the end, it was Mahmud II who issued a famous declaration that his subjects were all equal under the law. There was a famous instance of the final execution for apostasy, I think, took place in 1849. What happened was an Armenian got drunk and converted to Islam, and then he sobered up and converted back. Anyway, he was the last to lose his head for this. After that, it became impossible legally to execute someone for apostasy. This relationship between the dominant Muslim population and polity and the minorities is, of course, hugely relevant now, because we see the minorities not strong enough to resist a force of hostility and appropriation that is simply driving them out of the Middle East. Yet another reason why many people say, well, we need those authoritarians back in power, because at least they protected the minorities. It's a very, very difficult situation, and you will all be aware of the Pope's visit to Egypt, when he's clearly been deeply moved by the problems that the Copts have suffered.
Another question in our book relates to something you wrote in the book. You have a chapter in there called the Counter Enlightenment. It's a bookend to it's a chapter that bookends a lot of your book. And one of the things you mentioned in there is Hassan al-Banna. He's the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood. A lot of people, I'm sure, know the Muslim Brotherhood. But you say that in the beginning, they weren't necessarily a militaristic organization. And in fact, they modeled, like a lot of people in your book, modeled themselves on a lot of things that they witnessed in the West, and that they did something called the Young Men's Muslim Association, modeled after the YMCA. I found that really, really interesting. But a question from the audience is, which relates to that, is in the vein of for every action, there's an equal opposite, how the radical right, in a sense, has reacted two reforms. And one part of the question is, what advice for Muslim legal theorists might you have, or might someone have, who wish to embrace the concerns highlighted by liberal demands, but demonstrating to the public how they might be grounded in religious law? So that kind of, you know, conundrum, as it were, that you basically address in the book.
Absolutely. And I don't address anything in the book without it being addressed by the characters of the book. I follow my characters. And so a lot of what those characters who are most interested in political reform are doing is exactly that. They are finding concepts in the Western political life that they find attractive and universal, and then seeking out their equivalents in the Islamic past, in Islamic culture and tradition, and in Islamic law. In some cases, these can seem labored and contrived. And it is possible to criticize. It's possible to criticize them on those grounds. In others, it does seem, for example, completely irrefutable that the Prophet enjoined a consultation between a ruler and the ruled, and the modern word for a council in Arabic is derived from that original Quranic term. You can find, and people have done, particularly in the human rights sphere, that by consulting the original Islamic texts and the history of the example of the prophet, that there was something that you can call a proto-human rights agenda underway. You look, for example, at slavery. Now, slavery in the West was ultimately undone by a combination of politics, but also evangelical Christianity. Slavery in the Middle East and under Islam had always been very different from slavery, for example, in the antebellum American Deep South. It had been a lot more humane, and with the emphasis on manumission, on freedom, the child of a slave was not himself or herself a slave, and also the ability that slaves had to integrate into the higher echelons of society. Again, that very appealing lack of racial bias and prejudice that existed among Muslims. However, of course, slavery was slavery. You take someone from sub-Saharan Africa, you drive them up to the ports of Libya, you ship them across to Istanbul, where they are sold. And ultimately, that was undone by a combination of Western pressure and also internal realization that this situation couldn't go on. And those who reformed an institution like slavery and ultimately abolished it found evidence in the example of the Prophet Muhammad, whose emphasis was on regulating an existing evil that he probably felt he could not abolish, but whose clear direction of travel, whose clear drift of thought was towards alleviating the condition of slaves.
Another question from our audience relates to something that, of course, you write about in the book, and that is the Quran. And one of the things you mentioned in the book is how during the Islamic Enlightenment, there were people, just as there were at the time of the Prophet Muhammad, or shortly after, who were questioning the hadiths and other things about Islam that had become part of the canon. And some of these questioners were scared off and killed, and others were let, you know, to live in sort of in shriveled fashion, shall we say. But the question relates, the question is whether you see any development of a critical analysis of the Quran similar to the Enlightenment's encouragement of biblical criticism. And that's, I guess that's trying to take it into the modern age, but there was also criticism in the Enlightenment.
Well, I think this is an important, I'm only partially qualified to respond to this because my expertise, such as it is a historical rather than a Quranic one. However, some of the characters in the book were engaged in precisely this kind of thing, particularly the Chief Mufti of Egypt, Muhammad Abdul, who was notable for his outward-looking persona, the correspondence he had with thinkers in the West, including Tolstoy and Herbert Spencer, whom he visited in England, his travel, his broad breadth of vision and reference brought him a lot of criticism. And as Chief Mufti, he issued fatwas that indeed reinterpreted aspects of Islamic law. He received a letter from some Muslims who were living in South Africa, and these Muslims had come over from India, and he received a letter asking about whether they could eat meat that had not been killed in the halal fashion and by a Muslim butcher. And he found that under certain circumstances they could, and that brought him an enormous amount of criticism. There was the problem of Western headgear and Western fashion and Western dress sense. And again, he was addressing a much more mobile, a much more diffuse Muslim population that was now mixing into the Western world, looking forward, as it were, to the much larger waves of Muslim migration that we've experienced in our own lifetimes. And again, he came down in favor of, if it's easier for you to fit into a society wearing a Western headgear, then you should be allowed to do it. And to do this, you can either go back, you can find textual evidence to suggest that the well-being of the Muslim in the world trumps an individual piece of doctrine or an individual piece of dogma, and there are catch-all phrases in the texts that would allow much greater flexibility, and it is really that has exercised a lot of modern doctors of the law, the extent to which you can have ijtihad, which is the use of reasoning to arrive at a proper definition of the law, how dynamic and how much that can change according to time and place. And so there's a huge amount of disagreement over whether you can have dynamic ijtihad or whether you cannot. And it's along this line that some of the major disputes within Islam and on the legal front have been fought.
One of the things that I think is really important that kind of sets the foundation for the book is actually not in the book, and that is your personal experience living in Turkey, living in Iran. You spent many years in Iran, I think 4 or 5 at least. I wondered if you could just talk about, because so many books written about Islam are written from a theoretical perspective, an academic perspective. This book is not an academic book, although it has, an academic look to it because it has a lot of footnotes and it's very well researched. But I wondered if you could just talk about your personal connection to the book and how important it was that you lived in these countries. You speak, I believe, Turkish and Arabic and possibly Persian.
I speak Turkish and Persian. My Arabic is nowhere near as good as yours. No one should pick up my book thinking that they're going to get an academic, a watertight academic discourse. And in a university environment a few days ago, I was taken rigorously to task for my use of Jane Eyre at the beginning, and I apparently completely misunderstood Jane Eyre. So I feel much happier in a non-academic, addressing a non-academic audience. What I'm trying to do is introduce people to the characters and events, and that make the story just so utterly thrilling, in my opinion. And those characters and events, the reason I go for them is because of my background as a journalist, which is essentially as a storyteller. And I found a lot of good stories that one can tell. You're absolutely right. I haven't written my stories after a long period of meditation in the British Library. I've been out. I've been following what could be loosely called the developing world, but in particular Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, with forays into Pakistan, Iraq, and elsewhere since 1996. And I've simply felt that there was a glib acceptance of the idea that Islam had never had an enlightenment. And I was constantly, you know, talking to foreign diplomats in various countries. You know, the problem with country acts, you have to realize, is that Islam has never had an enlightenment. And this explains why human rights are so bad here, or why the trains don't run on time, or why there's corruption, or why this, that, and a whole load of very modern ills and ailments were sort of conveniently condensed into this one idea that Islam had never had an enlightenment, and of course had never had a reformation or industrial revolution. And I wanted to, I'd heard this so many times that I thought maybe someone should actually ask the question, has it? Is this absolute, is this piece of orthodoxy actually true? And it struck me, and again, academics will, you know, bridle at my definition of an enlightenment and whether or not that term can actually be applied to the processes that I'm talking about. But for me, an enlightenment suggests the advance of empirical knowledge, the advance of science, the retreat of all sorts of superstitions, religious and otherwise, the retreat of the clerical class as the repositories, as the guardians, the monopolizers of knowledge and of power. You know, one at a stroke in 1812 or 13, Muhammad Ali, the Pasha of Egypt, just confiscated an immense swathe of Egyptian land that had been under the thumb of the religious endowments. He didn't do that for altruistic reasons, of course, but it had an extraordinary effect on the prestige of the clergy. When the clergy both had religious power, was the only, if the clergy were the only people who could read, and they had vast acreage at their disposal, and they were the people you went to for all the sort of major events in your life and death, then this from that you understand just how powerful they were. But I'm drifting away from your question. My personal experience has indeed been absolutely vital, because I've just felt that there was a story to tell that hadn't been told yet.
And just a quick follow-up, in reading about your book and your biography, one of the things you mentioned is that as soon as you graduated from your studies in England, you wanted to get out of there, get the H out of there. And you're back, but you were curious, of course, about these worlds that you read about and studied academically. And actually, you could say that you're you know, journalist scholar in a sense, but there are a lot of people in this world who wouldn't take that approach, who actually understand the Muslim world from a very much an academic perspective. One question from the audience is about such a person, Donald Trump. And I don't know if you want to even go there, Christopher, about what your feeling is about the president's foreign policy, especially as it relates to Turkey. And if you don't, we could talk about Turkey itself, because there are lots of questions related to that.
I don't mind making... I think partly as an outsider, as a non-American, I think it would be out of place to pronounce too forcefully on, you know, a particular personality or particularly about the president, particularly since I've just picked up Celia's exhortation that we must all be civil. And I think that civility in all seriousness is extremely important, never more so than today. I think that there is within the administration and the people around the administration a worldview that accepts the view that I'm trying to counter in this book, the view that that Islam is resistant to change, resistant to the West, resistant to reform and modernity, but also that there's an ineluctable conflict between two very neatly differentiated civilizations, ours and theirs. And this I find you know, deeply wrong, and not just simply unadvisable, but I find it on a historical basis, on an empirical basis, to be completely wrong. And so I have written, I hope quite forcefully, against that, because I think that that kind of view leads only in one direction, and that is towards further confrontation. When what is needed so badly is a kind of empathy for the other. You don't have to identify yourself entirely with another way of thinking or another civilization, but I think it's extremely important to identify the elements that are universal and the elements that that essentially unite us all as human beings. And I think that is in danger of being lost. And I think it's part of that coarsening of the public discourse that doesn't allow for a more nuanced approach. Part of the Twitterization of our public sphere, you get your emotion out in a small number of characters, and of course that doesn't allow for expansion or for nuance or anything of that kind.
Well, it's a good time to say that one of our audience members describes your talk as your thoughts as very noble and well articulated. So I'll pause.
That's very generous.
We're down to probably our last question here, and there are lots of questions, but I'll try to amalgamate them into one. Really, I think a lot of people are curious about the way the period you're describing relates, of course, to the modern era, and especially with Turkey, recent events in Turkey with Erdogan and his consolidation of power, and what that means for the greater Middle East. One question from the audience is, how can we support this enlightenment when the U.S., U.K., Russia, et cetera, are propping up authoritarian rulers? And you write about, you know, again, one of the many areas you write about in the book is how the enlightenment happened with the background of these governments trying to appease Western governments, in fact, being ruled by them. Even if they weren't taken over, they were appeasing them. So there was still that foundational kind of restriction there. Can you address that in what might be the last question?
Right. What can we do when our governments seem to be increasingly led by what they perceive to be their self-interest? It's a narrow self-interest, and it's a short-term self-interest, if indeed it does mean that you're propping up or supporting militarists and authoritarians, because it only stores up trouble down the road. I would say that there's an obsession and a fixation with ISIS, particularly in this country, that bodes very ill for the future, because ISIS is on the verge of being defeated militarily. And the Americans have not given any thought to what is going to happen next. The short-term imperative of defeating ISIS on the field of battle will indeed be achievable. However, what happens that after that is at the moment what we have is a Syria that seems very unlikely to be susceptible to any kind of unified or at least a centralized government in the future. You have the Turks who have, having thrown in their lot with the opposition against Assad, have now come round to the idea that the only thing that matters to them is the prevention of the consolidation of a Kurdish reality in northern Syria. The Iranians and the Saudis are playing their proxy games to immense effect. And what can we do in the West? I think the West has lost an immense amount of authority, and it has happened for inadvertent reasons. The invasion of Iraq in 2003 was meant to be the apogee of Western achievement. We were meant to create a new reality across the Middle East, and regimes would topple into the welcoming embrace of democracy. The failure of that did an immense amount of damage to our prestige in the West. Funnily enough, Barack Obama's policy also, by retreating very overtly and explicitly from these engagements, also had a very detrimental effect on our or Western prestige in the Middle East. It seems very difficult now to come back from those two reverses, in both cases self-inflicted. So the answer is, the West can actually do rather little. It can try and avoid repeating mistakes. It can try and engage more seriously in the diplomatic side of things rather than the military side of things. The economy is still extremely important. The importance of the US remains extremely high, and it is salvageable. However, military operations, unless paradoxically they are very, very big, seem unlikely to yield results. And at the same time, an isolationist policy seems unlikely to yield results. What's needed fundamentally is a greater understanding of the region and a more nuanced approach that, in the first instance, stops the fighting, and secondly, involves a diplomatic approach that brings in Iran, Saudi Arabia, all of these foes. Iran is still a bogeyman in the United States. It shouldn't be. It's a competitor. It has interests that do not align with the United States. But you have to do business with these countries. Otherwise you won't either get your interests catered for, or bring about a better situation in the Middle East.
Thank you to our distinguished speaker, Christopher de Bellegue, for his presentation, The Islamic Enlightenment, the Struggle Between Faith and Reason. We also thank our audiences here and also those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel, today's moderator, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 113 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.